Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, I've got a drug recall announcement that I want to throw out. This is just a quickie. Generic levothyroxine from a company called Mylan, and a whole bunch of lots have failed their quality testing in the sense they do not contain within 5% of what it says on the bottle they contain, and that is the threshold for the FDA. I don't know, the company may have a tighter threshold. Levothyroxine is always one of those drugs that it's fragile. It's hard to make, and in the production process, storage, and packaging, sometimes you don't get it quite right. In this case, a lot of drugs expiring in 2025, but probably in many medicine cabinets. So levothyroxine, go pull out your bottle, check to see whether it is from Mylan, M-I-L-A-N. If it is, call your pharmacy and they can check to tell you whether or not your lot is one of the affected lots. Oh, I have a surprise here. Who's dropped from the sky? But Yanko, who is sitting here and putting on headphones and going on to mic two. Now, I should have told people, besides calling or emailing, you could also just walk into the studio and ask a question. So hello there.
Well, hello there, good doctor. I have a question here. I'm sure everybody's kind of concerned about this. It's about the health impacts of the Moss Landing battery fire. And what are your thoughts on the health implications of this disaster?
Well, the firefighters themselves are at higher risk for cancers. And, you know, in general, they're the group that will be, that will have the most exposure. But the people doing the cleanup at, not at the World Trade Center disaster are really, one of our living, you know, natural experiments, if we will, and we've got 20 years of tracking on them. So it's pretty clear that there's a linear correlation between the amount of exposure you had and your cancer risk of a whole bunch of primarily epithelial cancers. That is to say, surfaces, right? Things that line your lungs, line your bladder, line your nasopharyngeal pathways. Smoking is definitely an amplifier, so people who smoke are very much more at risk. People with COPD were very likely to experience exacerbations. Other things from a functional medicine thing that I worry about is those metals, the lithium, the cadmium, all of those rare earth, not so rare anymore, metals that are going up into the atmosphere every time there's a battery fire like this. And that could include a burning Tesla in front of the Trump building. That would also qualify as a heavy metal exposure. Now, these are very light, comparatively speaking, small molecules compared to, say, a plastic. So they're lightweight. They're going to go high. They're going to distribute. And they're going to come out in rain. So for people who live locally and garden, if you were within the evacuation area especially, but also if you were in the neighboring environs, you probably want to scrape about an inch of soil off of your garden beds and replace that with a potting mix or garden soil that you purchased, just because that's where the metals will settle. And they're not going to, and where you, if you do that now, because we are going to have rain soon, if you do that before the rains, you really will only need to brush to scrape off an inch. If you wait until the rain comes down, then it's going to go deeper, and I have no idea. So this is something I put out on, I do have an X feed, and I did put that out right away. Of course, protecting your lungs, I think that's a no-brainer. N95s actually do a decent job in a situation like this, and hopefully we've all got a few of those kicking around, and we should. If you don't, you know, go spring for them. Coming back to the heavy metals, there are two functional medicine tests that I would recommend for people who were heavily exposed, and either occupationally or because they're going to hit a lot of dust. I had tested some people who were up in Boulder Creek after the Lightning Complex fire and who went back early to clean up, whose homes survived, but they were living in that environment. And they had very high levels of acrylamide in their urine. In fact, levels that were outside of the range that the people in the lab, because I contacted them because it blew my mind. And they said, oh, yeah, we see that in firefighters. And acrylamide is kind of a plastic breakdown product, so it's a good surrogate marker. Back in the days before we had an AIDS test, we figured that everybody who had hepatitis B needed to be, because that's, you know, hepatitis B is passed by needle exchange and by sexual practices that would also put you at risk for AIDS. So if you had positive antibodies for hepatitis B, we just figured we better do, you know, complete precautions and pretend you had AIDS, because we had, you know, no way of really confirming that or not. And so that's what a surrogate marker means. So my thought is we should consider getting people tested. You can do a urine tox screen through Great Smoky's Laboratory. Costs about, I don't know, $100-$150. It's not super expensive. You might even be able to get your insurance to reimburse you, but don't hold your breath. Anyway, you'll be paying them for the test, and then you would at least know what your levels are in the immediate aftermath and how much detox you have to do. And I'll probably do a show on detox, but just the quick and dirty version of this is you can get rid of metals by sweating. So taking N-acetylcysteine, which helps you make glutathione, which helps you get rid of metals, and sweating regularly, hot baths with Epsom salts, far infrared saunas. Don't break a hip falling out of the tub. Be careful, because I'm going to tell you to sweat for about 15 minutes. So drink water, hopefully not out of plastic bottles. And and body brushing, you know, those boar bristle brushes they sell at the health food stores for body brushing. You can look it up online, but body brushing basically helps mobilize the subcutaneous tissue and get stuff into the lymphatics, which gets it into the bloodstream, which gets it into the kidney, which gets it into the urine, which is to say out. And that we want to do that. There are also natural chelating agents, but I'm not going to go into that at this time. So, one last thing. Any last things? Let's think. No, I think that's pretty much got it.
Yeah, some of our Facebook friends, basically, I think one of the most common symptoms that they're describing is this metallic taste in mm-hmm. the mouth, which I understand is common in with fires, I guess.
Yeah, there's a lot of, well, especially not forest fires so much as urban fires. Although, you know, plants do concentrate metals in the soil. But in this area, it's relatively pristine. You know, we don't have people, you know, burning electronics in our backyard most of the time. But when something like this happens, we do. And, you know, the places where in the India and other developing countries where all the batteries and all the crap, the old cell phones and everything gets dumped, they have a serious problem with this stuff. And they have those cancers. So it's a thing. We can detox. We should eat lots of fruits and vegetables. That's another thing you need if you're going to try to detox. But we should be very vigilant. And wearing when you're out there, you know, if you wear a mask if you're digging in your garden or if you're cleaning up an area that's, you know, going to have dust settled on it. If there's soot on your car, there's going to be soot in your lungs.
Well, thank you very much for that. Great advice, Doctor.
Well, thank you for the question. It had not occurred to me to cover it, and so I'm sure that everyone should be grateful to you, Yang, for asking it. Okay, so let's pivot and move on to bones and teeth, and then we'll be going to a couple of interesting emails that came in this week. But an exciting new study may change my mind on the bisphosphonates. These are the drugs that are taken either orally or by injection to treat osteoporosis, and they have some, you know, alarming side effects, and many of my patients read about the side effects, and they're just like, okay, I'm going to go see Dr. Dawn and find out what I can do for my bones naturally and how I can protect them. I've covered this topic many times on the program. I'm not going to revisit it tonight, but this study needs to be replicated, and I think it needs a larger study. This was only 1,000 women. but it's very, very interesting. So let me tell you about it. It was a study that showed that one or two doses of Reclast, which is zoledronate, a bisphosphonate that is given by intravenous infusion. It's used to treat Paget's disease, osteoporosis. It's used to stabilize bone in people who have bone metastases of cancer. It's used in multiple myeloma. Anyway, in this study, they gave one dose to the patients. And who were the patients? Well, they were women. Sorry, just going to open that up. 1,000 and change women between the ages of 50 and 60. The average age was 56. And these women had normal T-scores. Anything higher than, anything better than minus one. So that is to say minus one, minus 0.5, zero, or one. Your score, what we call a T-score, and I'll explain that in a minute, was you were in this group. Anybody who had more than that would not have been. So a person with greater than minus 2.5 would qualify as osteoporosis. These were women who were not diagnosed with osteoporosis. What they did was give them one infusion and then do a spinal x-ray. And then 5 years later, they got another spinal x-ray. And then 5 years after that, they got another spinal x-ray. A second group was given two shots, one at the onset and one 5 years later. A third group received no shots. And this, as I said, is in women who were not diagnosed and who were just simple postmenopausal women. Now, at menopause, women begin to lose bone. If they don't go on estrogen, they will lose between 0.5 and 1% of their bone mass a year for about 10 years. So depending on where you start, if you start off with, say, a 2.5 positive territory, you can probably afford to lose 1% of your bone and still be very safe from developing osteoporosis. But after about 10 years, the rate of loss slows down in almost everyone, not absolutely everyone, because the body adapts to the lower levels of estrogen and readjusts. What if we stabilize bone before this rapid decline? Well, it turns out, from this study at least, it suggests that very little drug is needed to compared to women with osteoporosis who are getting this infusion annually. Now, I would consider recommending this in postmenopausal women between 50 and 60 who have risk factors for osteoporosis. I don't think we should go there for everybody, but if you have a history of steroid use, if you have a family history of osteoporotic type fracture, and that would be like a spinal collapse fracture or a hip fracture that was not mitigated by, you know, falling down a flight of stairs, but was, you know, somebody tripped, got up, twisted on their feet in the kitchen and broke their hip. A fracture after 50 might be a risk factor. This needs to be studied further. We do get a bone scan in any woman who has a fracture after 50. The family history of osteoporosis and the fracture after 50 are structural issues. So it's important to remember you inherit not just your tendency towards osteoporosis, you also inherit the structure of your bones. And bones can have let's call it a good structure that's resistant to fracture, or they can have a structure that is not resistant to fracture. And we don't see that on a bone scan, okay? That just shows us density. So it's kind of like, imagine like the Buckminster Fuller geodesic dome, and that thing has very little weight of material in it. It's if you put that on a pallet, you could probably, you know, bring a whole thing in on a single pallet and build it. Whereas if you were trying to build a house of that square footage using our conventional materials, it'd take a lot more than one pallet. And yet they're strong and durable. So bones have a structural programming that we are not able to assess. That's why with these borderline DEXs, but a strong family history or a personal fracture after 50, that would be a group I might, despite having a normal bone scan, that'd be a group I might think about treating. Smokers. And when they did the study, they do an analysis called number needed to treat. So they found that the number needed to treat with one injection over the next 10 years, it cut the fracture rate in the spine in half. They used spinal fracture because that usually doesn't happen from falls. That usually happens spontaneously. So it's, and you can pick it up on an x-ray. So it made it an affordable study. The number needed to treat then was 20 women to prevent one fracture over 10 years. Just to put that in perspective, the number needed to treat in high-risk men, in other words, men with one or more risk factors for heart disease, is 50 with statins. So you would have to treat 50 men for 10 years with statins to prevent one heart attack. We still think that's a good idea. But just to put it in proportion, let's turn to side effects. Now, because we're giving such a lower dose of bisphosphonates, the side effects that one reads about are likely to be much less because you're not affecting as much bone. You're not stabilizing all of the bone. And so the two side effects that we worry about, one pretty rare, that's the mid-shaft femur fracture, which is almost never seen except in people who've been on bisphosphonates for a long time and more than 10 years. We figured this out a while back and started limiting people to a 5-year treatment. But even that still shows a higher prevalence for these fractures. Japanese women are more at risk. So again, that might be a reason to not give a bisphosphonate to them, or it might be a reason to give it to them. The data is just not there. But I want to spend a moment on osteonecrosis. So osteonecrosis, although it's a general term that means dead bone, it actually refers to a phenomenon that happens in the jaw when there's rot or decay in a tooth, and you work on that, you know, scrape out the tooth, try to get rid of the decay, or even extract the tooth. That thing has to heal. And if the person has been on bisphosphonates, they prevent bone breakdown, which also means that it prevents the formation of new bone in that location. So it slows down healing, ironically, because you got to clean up the pad before you can build a new house. I am really shocked because dentists don't specifically screen for this drug when but they screen for heart murmurs, right? And if you have a heart murmur, the dentist wants a letter from your doctor saying it's safe to clean your teeth. I mean, they're really worried about this complication of causing infection of a heart valve, as they should be. However, this osteonecrosis is, you know, debatably worse because now you're going to have to you've got bacteria growing in the bone. You're going to have to surgically dig that out, make a bigger hole, which is then not going to heal. So this is a bad thing, especially since it can kind of rot. It can be like dry rot in a house where you don't see it and you don't know it's there. And so I definitely do a careful dental hygiene check before prescribing these drugs. And I encourage the patients I remind them at their physicals, you know, how are you seeing your dentist? Are your teeth okay? Before you get a dental surgery, and particularly anything involving the bones of the jaw, and you've been on a bisphosphonate or have ever received it, because they don't ask you that, right? What drugs are you on? Maybe they ask that, but they don't ask you, have you ever taken this drug? And ever taken this drug is a risk. The recommendation currently is stop the drug for 5 or 6 months before you get an implant or anything else where you're working on the jaw so that you know it will heal. So just saying, this is pretty significant data. It looks really good. There's always a dark side to these agents, but I think I can see a way clear to benefiting a lot of women and doing it safely. So I'm pretty excited and can't wait to see where this takes things. So we're going to go to our emails. And the first of these, I think the first one I'll read is the one from Tim. Tim in Nebraska. He should go first because he actually identified himself. And Tim sent me a link to an article in JAMA. It's a commentary article about some work that's being done. And his comment was, how many people were booted off of social media, were called quacks or other horrible things because they were saying the same thing years ago? So the title of the article is, In Search of COVID-19 Vaccines That Elicit Mucosal Immunity and Stop Transmission. And so, Tim, I wonder if you were actually able to read the article. I was not, because I hit a paywall here. That's like $40 to buy the article. So I can't, I don't know if you have a membership or if you just like read the first two sentences, but from the first two sentences and the comments that appear, I would infer that this article may have been spread by social media links claiming that this is somehow a vindication of chloroquine or inhaling bleach and all those, you know, all those January 6th martyrs, all of those, brave COVID martyrs who were trying to spread the word about, the conspiracy to keep them from getting adequate therapy. Whoever was listening to me in 2020 would have heard me talk about colloidal silver in the nose to basically create mucosal immunity since we didn't have a vaccine and put something in there that would be harmless and would likely prevent viruses. We know that colloidal silver works for cold virus, and COVID is very close in its mechanism to cold viruses and similar viral coat, protein coat on the outside. There's no reason to expect that silver wouldn't deactivate it. It's like saying, well, this axe chops down a redwood, but it wouldn't chop down an oak tree. No, it's an axe. It'll do just fine on either one. So I want to thank you, however, Tim, even though I think you may have misinterpreted here in terms of what this article is actually saying, since I wasn't able to read it, because you made me search. And I found a great article talking about the current research on vaccines that get sprayed into the nose, not injected, because those can induce mucosal immunity. So that means essentially you inhaled some COVID, it immediately hits antibodies that are in your snot and is deactivated because, you're going after that spike protein. No spike protein, no way to get into the cell, no way to infect you. And the other thing is, how are we spreading COVID? We're spreading it through the nose. So people cough, they sneeze. If you get to the mucosa, then the COVID that you've got is less likely to sit around in your nose and it's going to get deactivated by your own antibodies. So I think what would be really ideal, particularly in high-risk people, would be, get the antibody in the bloodstream. So go ahead and do, one injectable. But maybe instead of injecting everybody every year, which I think is going to not work and clearly isn't working, nasal spray, one squirt in your nostril once a year with the latest version of COVID so that the mucosal immunity is going to deactivate most of it and your humoral and your T-cell immunity won't be overwhelmed and you get sick. And this would be particularly a good strategy for the elders. So I'll stay tuned. And like I said, sometime in February, I will get around to reading that article and abstracting it for you. And I hope that you will be listening to that program. Thank you again to Tim in Nebraska. Okay, and this one, second one here, let me just stop and say, we're about to We'll be taking a short break in a moment. During that break, if you'd like to give me a call, pick up your phone, 831-900-5773. Or if you can double track, go ahead and shoot me an email or shoot me a message on the Vox Pop section on the KSQD app. We're very excited to have that, and I am still holding my breath to see what happens. Let's go to this anonymous article. The title is Prosthetic Contact Rash Reduction by Transplanting Foot Sole Cells. And so I'm going to just move over to the actual article which appeared in The Scientist. So this is an abstract. But basically, this is about injecting fibroblasts from the soles of people's feet into thighs. So this is primarily looking at people who have amputations. And, you know, when you walk around barefoot, the skin on the soles of your feet is very, very thick compared to the skin on the top of your foot. I think we're all aware of that. For many years, since people started surviving amputations and we started to develop prosthetic, you know, initially peg legs like Long John Silver, and now in the case of people with, let's say, Iraq war veterans, we've got these robo legs, but they still have to fit on the person's body. And that's difficult because we build a fiberglass sleeve and it fits over the stump. But when we do an amputation, we don't have a handy sole of the foot. So what we're doing essentially is saving some skin and some muscle, cutting that we can then literally roll over the raw flesh and sew it up and create, ideally, a nice tubular, I would say conical, but it's a truncated conical, and I don't remember the geometric term for that, but you probably don't know it, so it doesn't matter. Anyway, what it does is you've got a skin surface, it's covered, it heals, you can put some weight on it, but it's not designed to bear the weight of a human body. So the skin breaks down. Essentially, people get pressure ulcers and sores and cuts and rashes on their stump, and then they can't wear their prosthetic, no matter how sophisticated it is. And this is a huge impact on their quality of life. If you are interested, there's a really good description of what this is like during World War II in Phillips Roth, The Plot on America. And what they show is how difficult it is, with great descriptions of what it's like for someone. Philip Roth's book is a very interesting book. I think possibly a really good read to revisit right now, because it is essentially about suppressing Jewish citizens in the United States, and a very, very interesting perspective of a young boy. This is a fictional past. It is not what actually happened. But it has a plausibility, which is, you know, the whole fascist takeover of America between 1920 and 1940. It is kind of resonating right now. The skin on the soles of the feet is thicker. It's built to absorb hot mechanical pressure and compression. So in recent research, a group at the John Hopkins School of Medicine that is headed by Luis Garza looked at transplanting fibroblasts from the skin of people's feet and injecting it into the stumps of people who had amputations. In this case, it was not into actual people with amputations. It was into thigh skin in people with the idea that if they get some thickened skin on the surface of their thigh, this is not a deal breaker. You have to be able to make sure that you know how to do it. All sorts of details. How far apart do you inject them? What frequency? We don't have a best practice here, but what they did show was that allotransplantation, which means transplanting something from one part of your body to the other, of these deep fibroblasts did change the skin traits. And it's not just the fibroblasts, it's the skin traits of the other cells. Now, experiments in the 60s had revealed that fibroblast-containing low dermis of the skin determines the identity of the outermost skin layer. If you think about your skin, you've got palm skin, you've got the relatively hairless skin in parts of your body, shaft of the penis, for example, and labia minora. This is more. You've got the mucous membranes inside your mouth. You've got the skin on your scalp that grows hair, which is a little bit more like the skin on the sole of your feet in some ways, but doesn't have the property that the sole of your feet do in the way that it makes skin behave. So basically, if you take those deep fibroblasts and inject them into the same, from one tissue, palm, the sole of the foot, and inject it into the front of the thigh or the side of the inside of the thigh, which is nice and thin skin, the stem cells in the fibroblasts are basically a kind of stem cell. They can grow in different directions. They're not terminally differentiated, we say, but they are not the cells that become squamous skin cells. However, they actually direct the epigenetics of the squamous skin cells. And when they injected this into the thighs, they got 5 months later, they did a skin biopsy, and they found that the skin was now showing all of those volar features. It was thickener. It was thicker. It had different diameter of collagen fibers, and it had more elastin, and it was different kind of elastin. So that's our stretchy component that allows our skin to deform and then bounce back. And of course, they did RNA sequencing on the tissues because you can, and they were able to look at the expression of the genes happening in the squamous cells at the fibroblast injection sites. So this is a really foundational study that is important, not just for its effect on amputation, but because lots of other tissues have fibroblasts. For example, lungs have fibroblasts, and we can't get good lung regeneration. Well, maybe we can. Maybe we can re-epithelialize lungs that have been damaged by exposure to volatile organic compounds or fire or heat. Yeah, maybe we can regrow things. That would be just awesome if we could actually do that. And I think that this idea that if you find the right cell, they talk to each other. We know that. They talk to each other. And you just have to figure out the language, and then you can use it and do amazing things with these stem cells. Let's move on to some rather interesting work on gallstones, okay? So I have been discouraging people with Parkinson's disease from having general anesthesia. I think that there's epidemiological data, and certainly people report, of course, I don't think we've got any placebo trials, that'd be hard to do, that they deteriorate, that their Parkinson's deteriorates rapidly, you know, to a newer low after general anesthesia. And there does seem to be a soft correlation with how long the surgery lasted. But honestly, folks, this is fuzzy data. And if you have a life-threatening condition or you're suffering severely, you want to get that surgery. You kind of have to throw the dice here. But if you can possibly get your hip replaced with spinal anesthesia, well, or your knee, well, do that, because going under has perhaps stronger consequences as we age in general anyway. But in Parkinson's disease, those cells that are controlling their movement are sick. And the last thing you want to do is kick a cell while it's down. Anyway, so I went studying and went looking because a patient came in who has early Parkinson's disease and who also has a recent episode of abdominal pain, went to the emergency room and was diagnosed with gallstones. Now, I took a careful history and did an exam, and he clearly did not have an active gallbladder problem. I looked at his scans, and yes, they do show gallstones, so check. But I would kind of tend to classify these as provisionally asymptomatic gallstones. And I thought to myself, well, let's think about what we do for diabetics. With diabetics, if you find gallstones and the person has no symptoms, you take them out because diabetes damages the nerves. So you may not have your symptoms, even though you're having the pain. Secondly, diabetics get something that nobody else manages to get, which is gangrene of the gallbladder. And if that happens, it's very lethal. So they have exceptional risk. So taking out a gallbladder that's got stones but is otherwise asymptomatic is a reasonable thing to do. But that practice that is justified in diabetics may be questionable across the population, but it's become kind of standard. Oh, you have gallstones, go get surgery. You know, mission creep, shall we say. So I went looking because I remembered that pregnant women, you don't want to take out their gallbladder. Opening up the abdomen in a pregnant woman is, well, just suffice to say, no, we don't go there. So this is, well, I shouldn't say we don't go there. We go there in a cesarean section, but we don't want to trigger labor. And doing it earlier in a pregnancy can definitely trigger miscarriage. So women are given ursodiol. This is a substance that is essentially the molecule that is in bear bile. Now, bile has various bile acids, and they're numerous, and I had to memorize them at one point, but I no longer can help you with that. The ursodiol, however, has different properties. So it kind of acts as a solvent for gallstones. And if you get it's a little bit like, you know, things going into saturation. You know, if you have water and you stir sugar into it, and there's a point where you can't get any more sugar to dissolve, and you've saturated the water. If you then just take it till it's finally all dissolved, not quite so much sugar in there, and then you just let it sit and the water evaporates, the crystals will start that were previously in solution will come out of solution. And that's very analogous to how gallstones form. You've got a certain combination of fluid and bile acids, and they precipitate, just like that sugar, as the water evaporates. So you could add more water, and that's effectively what the ursodiol does, and it takes the gallstones back into solution. So I came across an article, and this was in the American Journal of Surgery, and it was September 1989. Now, you might have published this in the American the Journal of the American Medical Association, because let's just say that surgeons kind of have a vested interest in doing surgery, and publishing this talking about medical therapy to dissolve gallstones was not going to get a big bounce from the surgical community. They'd find all kinds of reasons. But ursodiol is available. It's not expensive. It's gone generic. And that's pretty cool. One moment. And what the ursodiol does is shrink the gallstones. What this article says is if you do extracorporeal shockwave lithotripsy, you can break up the gallstones into smaller little gallstones, and they're thereby speed up the dissolution, maybe completely get the gallstones melted and get them out of the body. Now, this particular patient had lost a lot of weight very quickly. He'd gotten religion on fitness and diet and had been very successful, but he went from having gallbladder sludge to gallstones, just like you'd expect with that supersaturated solution of sugar that the water starts to evaporate. The same thing happened to him as he lost weight. So we need to think in terms of looking at bile acids and lithotripsy as a alternative to surgery in people who have exceptional risk factors. And this is just a real game changer, in my opinion. And I did not find that it got a lot of bounce. And I have a person where, you know, honestly, I'm going to try it. I checked. Medicare does pay for it in people who have contraindications to surgery. And so I think I can make this one fly. Stay tuned, and I'll let you know. It's now to get my pen, which is mightier than the sword, they tell me, and slash my way through the wilderness of prior authorizations. So wish me luck. We have a caller on the line. Hello, this is Dr. Dawn. Welcome.
Yes, dear Dr. Aline Smith calling.
Hello, Aline.
Coincidence for you to mention about our bones and our joints, and I just went to get for osteoporosis in my knees. It's amazing, the miracle of the cortisone. I'm walking 99.5% better on the right knee leg and just got the cortisone today for the left knee.
Yeah, I think you have osteoarthritis.
Yeah, didn't I say that? Oh, excuse me.
That's all right.
Wrong terms, all the medical stuff.
Oh, God, yes, and it's Latin, so.
And I met a woman who's a pre-med student as I was waiting and waiting and waiting for the guy to get the PPA to get my chart.
Oh, cool.
And I gave her, it was too complicated and scientific, about the, there's an abbreviation for the shots for the 9 or 10 different kinds of shots for bones.
Right, bisphosphonates is the category there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, or that's the main one. And there's other drugs that we give for bones. And in terms of the steroids, of course, those are going not into the bones, but into the joint to calm down the inflammation.
Mm. And you reminded me, and it was a coincidence again, when I had had a fracture back some years ago. And I walk and exercise, of course, the femur bone.
Mm, yeah.
And then I slid on some gravel up at the Quaker Center. That was years ago.
Lovely place, by the way, folks, if you haven't been up there.
The road, so I had skidded that gravity rules, that we humans have to cope with gravity.
Oh, I used to be part of a climbing group called the Gravity Warriors.
Oh, what a great name. I think you mentioned it.
I love the name. Okay, yeah, well, what's your question?
I guess I don't know what else to do besides taking vitamin D3.
For
my bones.
For your bone health.
After menopause that I've been taking forever.
Well, you got it. Vitamin D3 helps you absorb calcium, so you've always got to get calcium. And I have been for a couple of years now recommending that people also get vitamin K2.
Oh, that's right.
And because that keeps the calcium from going into your arteries. See, calcium will go into soft tissues or it'll go into bones. We want to send it to the bones.
K2.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I'm not going to read it, but I want to refer everybody and you on page 28, a wonderful elaborate article about vasectomies. Yay!
Page 28 of what, dear?
Of the Good Times. Excuse me.
Well, you know, there are other newspapers in the world, but I admit that one's the best.
Say, page 28 is Good Times.
Okay.
Thank you,
and I will go look for it. And
yes. Maybe you can refer to it.
I probably
show about vasectomies.
Oh, well, I have some stories.
Ooh.
I have some stories. I got trained in something called no scalpel vasectomy.
Yes.
And the guy who invented the instrument actually taught the class.
Mm.
And he would just, like, he would just find this little piece of linguine in there and squeeze the skin over it. And he had this hemostat, the curved hemostat, or a red clip hemostat, and he sharpened it till it was knife-like. And then he would just basically go poke, twist, grab, and clip.
Yeah.
And it was, he got up to being able to do about 50 an hour.
Oh, my God.
Now, of course, he had an assistant to minister, but 50 an hour he was working. It's like,
God, he must be a millionaire.
No, actually, he was doing this in, he was doing this in India. So, so he probably wasn't getting a very high state paid. Pardon me. It wasn't getting a very high price per head. So.
That's right.
All right.
One more thing, I guess it reminds me of years and years and years ago, went to Planned Parenthood when they used to be on Laurel Street, and I watched the a vasectomy video of that new technique.
Hello?
You don't see it?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I actually just emailed you.
Okay.
My question is about some extreme pain I'm having, like on my tailbone. If I sit for any extended period of time, like it's on the area where you sit when you're riding a bike. I'm 73. I'm pretty healthy.
Right.
And I was asking you what a DEX or DEXA.
Oh, that was your call too. Okay. I saw that
yeah.
one.
It
didn't ring for me because I'm going to read your email. Okay. Please talk about a DEXA scan, what it's for. Is it for osteoporosis? I'll answer that. So it's a dual X-ray. And so they shoot two different frequencies of X-ray beams into the bones. And by the way the beams absorb differently, they can calculate how dense the bones are. Kind of like when you knock on the drywall to find the stud, if you think, okay?
Yeah.
It's a bit like that. So the density gives you a different, the density of the stud sounds different. And so that's a wave, that's, you know, a different kind of wave than an X-ray in terms of its directionality, but it has the same properties. So... So once we have that information, that tells us about the density of the bones. We know that women reach their maximum bone density at 35. So that's kind of that's the best place to be. That's the top of the heap, so to speak. And it takes it's until 35 to build up the bone. And then after 35, it slowly, slowly, slowly decreases. And then after menopause, it more quickly decreases. So, and of course, how high your peak was and how much you have to lose, it's sort of like retirement, right? If you've got $10 million, you're probably not going to live long enough to use it all. So, okay. So, and you just have to last until you fall off the cliff. So it's all good. What you're describing on the tailbone, the area that you sit with the bicycle seat, there are two bones. If you look at a picture of the pelvis, they're called the ischial processes. I actually call them the bicycle bones to my patients. You can reach down right now in your butt crease and you can find them, and you don't need to because you know where they are because they're talking to you. But anybody else who wants to, you can feel them. And those bones have a shock absorber pad called a bursa. And what it sounds like to me is that you have ischial bursitis. And that can come from falling. It can come from sitting on a hard chair. Sometimes it can come because it just comes. And sometimes
how do you say that word,
ischial is ischial. Sorry, I had to visualize.
Okay.
And so ischial bursitis, bursitis, and that can, those are very accessible. Our previous caller was talking about injections. Yep, you can inject that bursa and calm it down. And it's an area where, you want to know what you're doing. It's in the vicinity of the sciatic nerve, although you'd have to work really hard to hit the sciatic nerve. But if you're anywhere remotely over the bone, there's not much you're going to damage, even if you go all the way down to the bone with the needle, but you don't need to. But you want to get close to the bone and then inject the steroid. It'll spread through the bursa. and it's an effective way of treating ischial bursitis.
Did you say inject a steroid?
Yep, you inject just a local steroid, just like the lady was talking about where they put it in her knee. I put steroids in bursas and knees and shoulders all the time in the office. It's basic kind of primary care. And, you want to get deep enough that you don't inject into the skin, because it will thin the skin, which is the last thing in the world you need in that location, because, you're already having enough trouble. Padding is good. Even if you don't need a Depends, you can pad the area. So if you do have to sit for a while, using a foam cushion, or if you're in a social situation where you don't want to walk around with a cushion, you can do other things. Yeah.
I have several different kinds of cushions, and it's still like I can use it for a little bit and then just back to, I have to change it into another different cushion.
I would urge you to go and try go to your primary care doctor, or if they don't feel comfortable doing it because they're young and weren't taught the procedure, I can, ask them to refer you. And this is pretty basic kind of orthopedic PA type thing that they can do.
Okay, but that shot is going right up into the little soft area of bursitis?
It's going right above the bone where there's think of it like moleskin. You have an area that's rubbing on your shoes, so you put some moleskin on so you don't get a blister, because last time you wore those shoes, you got a blister, like that.
Okay. All right. Sounds painful, but thank you so much.
Oh, it's not too bad, actually. But it's scary. Okay. Let's just say that that's a very psychologically vulnerable part of the body, so it's nice if you're working with someone that you've met rather than someone that you've never seen before.
Yeah, I happen to have a really excellent, very excellent provider.
I'm so glad to hear it. It makes a big difference.
Clinic. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long. And stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.